Welcome to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin. Well, do you know what – do you have any idea what a Bitcoin is? I mean, we're talking about Bitcoins, and all we know is, well, they've gone up from a dime to $20,000, and some of our friends we thought who were stupid and purchased them are now rich, and we're wondering – why didn't we jump on the bandwagon? Well, Lawrence Baxter, who teaches at Duke in the law school and in all sorts of topics, both in the practice of law, and he's co-director of the Global Financial Markets Center at Duke Law School. And he wrote an article that was picked up by the Wall Street Journal a few days ago, which both began to explain what Bitcoins are and then to explain really what the risk of ownership. So welcome, Professor Baxter.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about why Bitcoins have gone up in value and why you're worried that someday soon they may have zero value.
Zero value. Well, perhaps the best place to start is to say what Bitcoin is not, and it is not a gold coin, despite the icon that is everywhere as a shiny gold
coin. Nothing you could hold on to.
No, I think a lot of people think they are something like Krugerrands and American Eagles and Canadian maple coins.
Loons. And
yeah, absolutely not. And that's an interesting way, I think, to contrast it with the history of money. We all know that wampum and shells and all kinds of tangible things were used as part of exchange for buying and selling goods. And of course, we've moved a long way forward. We used to have gold-backed currency, and we now have what's called fiat currency, which is that it is literally paper currency or ledger entries that exist only because people are willing to accept that they are the money that they can use.
Based on the strength of a nation's financial strength,
yes,
or something like that.
And that's actually a very important point because whereas you used to have tangible currency, and you may remember the old Charlie Chaplin movies, when he was given a nickel, he would bite it to see if it was real and not a wooden nickel. And the phrase, I think, is still don't take no wooden nickels. We moved into this gold-backed paper currency. So it was perceived that gold was backing its value. You could go to the Treasury and then the Federal Reserve later to claim gold in exchange for the paper money. We moved off that partly in the Roosevelt era, but finally in 1973 with Richard Nixon, when he took the U.S. dollar off the gold standard and any kind of gold backing. And we entered a world of this fiat currency. But it is still backed. It's backed by the United States, by our gross domestic product.
Were other countries doing the same thing?
Yes.
Pretty much in lockstep, or kind of lockstep?
Not at
us.
The same time, but very close to. There was a lot of disenchantment with gold-backed currency for various reasons. And at that time, the dollar was becoming by far the most dominant currency, so that countries were starting to measure their currency by the value of the dollar. And with the Bretton Woods Agreement after World War II, we also moved away from fixed exchange rates. And so we entered a world in which currencies were all relative to each other. And the strength of the currency depended on the strength of the country and its production and its ability to tax to back that currency. The U.S. soared out in front as by far the most trustworthy currency, to the point that the French president, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, said it was an exorbitant privilege that America enjoyed. And to this day,
it has been.
To this day, yes, because it was simply an indication of the confidence that the world had in the U.S. economy.
Does the U.S. government back it, or is it the Federal Reserve System that manages the money supply?
The Federal Reserve System manages the money supply, but it's essentially in the end, if anything were to be challenged, it would have to be backed by the U.S. government in terms of their tax-raising capability. And, of course, we still do have stores of gold, but nobody seriously measures it by that, even though many countries actually have their gold stored in New York.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, yes, indeed. And we all know about Fort Knox. And
We've seen James Bond movies.
Yeah, exactly. Goldfinger was an effort to break the currency.
Well, the help me with this. The Federal Reserve, working under the guidelines that the U.S. and the strength of the U.S. financial system, tries to have a dollar, which is a respected value. Mm-hmm. And yet I read every month that things are going wrong because we haven't achieved our inflation rate.
Right.
And to have supposedly a solid dollar that you can rely on, and then to say, hey, we're going to diminish the value of it 2% every year.
Sure.
How does that fit in
Inflation is actually a much older problem, and it emerges in various ways, and various types of money either can or cannot stop it. So if we go all the way back to gold as the medium of exchange, one of the common tricks that sovereigns used to do was to clip off, and merchants did this too, would clip off bits of the gold and thereby actually slowly diminish the value of the currency, which would then lead to people demanding more of it in exchange for what they sold, and of course then you get inflation. A famous example was in France, where they hit on the idea of printing paper currency and printed vast amounts of it, leading to extreme inflation and the near collapse of the French monarchy at the time, just before the French Revolution. And it was really only in the 70s and 80s with monetary theorists like Milton Friedman that it came to be understood that you had to have some kind of regulation over that money supply, or you would inevitably get inflation if there was too much money in the system. And central banks started to get better and better at controlling the amount of that money.
A central bank is a branch of the Federal Reserve, or is it other?
Other countries have central banks like the Bank of England, Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank.
And Federal Reserve is our central bank?
Yes, but interestingly, we're not allowed to call it a central bank because that was part of the political compromise at the beginning of the 20th century in 1913 when the Federal Reserve was created. So what ours looks like is 12 regional Federal Reserve banks that perform central banking functions. The New York Federal Reserve, which performs most of the practical day-to-day functions, and then all of that's overseen by the Board of Governors of the Fed, which is in Washington. So that complex arrangement constitutes our central bank, though it is never called that officially. It's the Federal Reserve System. And so monetary policy theorists garnered a lot of popularity, were able to demonstrate why inflation could be kept under control if the Federal Reserve System in the U.S. and central banks in other countries controlled the amount of money such that it grew commensurate with gross domestic product but no faster. And to this day, the Fed controls it every single morning through the New York Federal Reserve with what are called open market operations, where they will either increase the money supply or reduce it. And I can go into those details.
Well, if the Federal Reserve is charged with having enough money in the chain to facilitate the commercial transactions, mm-hmm. and have a reliable backing for it.
Yeah.
Back to the question about the programmed or the target inflation, the mm-hmm. target inflation, is that a target so we don't want to have – we're limiting inflation, or is it a target we need to have at least that much inflation in order to have some positive aspect mm-hmm. to our currency?
And the answer to all of that is yes, in different ways. So in order to reduce inflation, they will contract the money supply by changing the target interest rate, which the most common one is the federal funds rate, which is the rate at which banks borrow through the Federal Reserve banks overnight. They can reduce the interest rate by increasing the amount of credits to the banks that all member banks have to have accounts with the Fed. And they can increase the credits to those banks, which would mean that there's more money in the system, or they can reduce it, thereby transferring to the banks the responsibility to charge higher or lower interest rates. So if you've got less funds available or they're less, if you need more funds, you're going to have to pay more for it when you borrow it from another bank. So then the question is, how do they increase or reduce that? And the biggest method is what's called open market operations. That means that the Fed, through the New York Federal Reserve Bank, buys or sells securities in the open markets. And when it does that, let's say it sells securities, It'll sell securities to primary dealers, prime dealers, who will then pay for it by means of debits in their bank accounts. That reduces their money supply, and they've got securities that are sitting out there that are not money. The reverse happens where they buy securities. So if the Fed buys a lot of securities in the open market, it credits these banks with more money in their accounts, that bringing down the cost of the money. And we saw this on a massive scale in recovering from the financial crisis, where the Fed bought all kinds of securities to pump, as it's termed, pump liquidity into the system. That is, to get money into the hands of the banks.
The Fed, to help me with this, the Fed bought, and we remember this, it was much discussed during the crisis with some people, alarmist to
highly
say.
Highly controversial programs. Yeah. Yes, to this day, they are highly controversial.
And if the Federal Reserve decides to buy securities in the open market, do they just write a check for it? Or how does that work?
They will simply register a credit to the seller.
So they can do that without printing more money. They can just creating more money.
But they are meant to take, for example, when they're meant to sell on good collateral. So there's meant to be securities when banks borrow from the Fed. This is another method of by which they can control the money supply. So these are meant to be secured loans that will be paid back, and the securities will be returned, the collateral. Or they can just do it by simply buying or selling and passing the credits, which gets us to what many people complain about, which is that it is just fiat money. It is at the will of the Fed. There's no extra gold that's brought in. Or anything else that's tangible.
Well, if you joined us late, we're going to talk about Bitcoin. But Professor Lawrence Baxter has graciously agreed to educate us a little bit on how normal money is created and managed in the United States. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back and ask him again to talk about Bitcoin and how that fits into the way we the money that we're used to. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and this is a program about Bitcoin. And we got the expert from over at Duke to come talk to us. Professor Lawrence Baxter teaches in the law school and teaches about money. I guess that's the best way to in the context of the international economic system. Thanks for coming, and thanks for the kind of background about the money that we rely on. And I would have to say I don't clearly understand it, but I'm persuaded that if I put a dollar in the bank, I'm going to get it back. Or if I invest it, I can get it. If I sell something, I can take dollars and I can get exchange. I mean, it's a pretty good system, isn't it?
Well, you're touching on one of the key issues that relates to Bitcoin. You trust the system. And the question then is, why do you trust it? So if we take Bitcoin on the one side and contrast it with your Federal Reserve notes, your greenbacks, as they used to be called, you will trust a greenback because we have a deeply embedded trust system that has evolved around the way in which that currency is issued. And it goes back all the way back to 1863. With Bitcoin, you have to trust each other. So the contrast is, I was talking about how the Fed can control the money supply through open market operations and crediting banks' accounts and making loans available through the discount window. Bitcoin doesn't operate with any central agency like that at all. It is, in fact, the whole purpose for its existence is that it operates on what's called a distributed ledger system, which means that if I buy something from you with Bitcoin, the transaction is between you and me, not to the Fed and back. I buy something paying you with Bitcoin because you may, at that point, attribute a certain amount of value to Bitcoin. All of it depends on trust. And so the big question is, well, what leads to trust with Bitcoin when there's
can
no
I, can I transfer
bank?
Can I buy, give you a Bitcoin in, either in payment for something or just as you purchase it from me, and you say that's independent. Can the two of us do this without any help from any other agent or agency? I mean, how does that work?
There is a mechanism in place to ensure that it's a valid transaction and that there's some stability to the system, and that is an infrastructure called blockchain. Blockchain is a set of blocks that keep getting added to that operate off both a public key and a private key.
What's the key?
The key is a hash, essentially a hash numeral system that is very complicated, and only you can complete the transaction, which itself is based on the public key. It's all recordable, and it's unique in that nobody else in the world can use that hash.
But if it's recorded somewhere, yeah. Where is it recorded in some central Bitcoin?
No, recorded between you and me, and then traceable by anybody else who wants to trace the origin of that Bitcoin. So it's imagine when we record a deed with the county registrar. That's a central recording system. So somebody else will come and they go to the county, or let's say it's a probated will. They'll go to the probate officer and ask to see a copy of it if they have a right to see it. That's a centralized validation system. Blockchain and Bitcoin seek to eliminate that centralized operative.
So that you and I can do business without anybody else knowing about it?
Yes. Somebody else can trace it if they have a reason. For example, if you turn around and sell But it's seriatim, yes. It's in series along, and that's the reason it's called a distributed ledger.
So if I sell you a Bitcoin and it has my numbers on it and it'll have yours on it, you sell it to someone else, can that person trace that all the way back?
Only? In theory, yes. And that raises privacy issues, and it raises a question of reliability. So these codes on which Bitcoin is mined, and we must talk about Bitcoin mining in a while, they are extremely complex and unique. And so the idea is that at any one point, a totally reliable trace of the transactions can be accessed. Not by anybody, but by people who have a one-to-one access.
You mentioned that there's no tangible coin. That it's not like a gold coin.
No.
So where does this Bitcoin live?
Right. There are what are called Bitcoin vaults, which are essentially records of those hashtags that will that you have unique access to. So you can retrieve your Bitcoins from these vaults. In theory, a hacker can't get at them because they don't have your private key.
But who manages this Bitcoin pocket? Is that what you call it?
Vault.
A vault.
Bitcoin vault.
Somebody's got to be there.
Yeah.
And how do they get paid?
There are companies that have created vaults. Some of them have pretty nefarious records, like Silk Road. There have been a number of vaults that have been intruded by hackers, and it's turned out they're not as safe. In fact, where they've gone and they've discovered Bitcoin.
Well, if you buy a Bitcoin from me and you own it, do you have to do something to get it?
I have a little piece of paper that has the code, my Bitcoin code. And that's my evidence.
And who gave that to you?
If you go to a Bitcoin ATM, for example, and believe it or not, there are Bitcoin ATMs, and you buy, let's say you buy a whole Bitcoin, which means you have to spend a lot of money now, it will produce a token that has that code on it.
And that's your evidence of ownership.
Yes.
If you lose that, too bad. You've lost it.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's also true.
How is that different from having a silver or a gold certificate? I have my certificate that shows that somewhere in that vault is my Bitcoin, and if I lose it, it's gone. If how do I then transfer it?
In some respects, it's not that very different. In fact, there are now initial coin offerings which are to trade certificates based on these Bitcoins. It's not much different. And it's part of the ideology supporting Bitcoin is to get us back to something like that, which is not dependent on Fort Knox. It is to say, I have this value and I don't need a central bank or the Federal Reserve System to validate that I have this value or to manipulate it. There's the big concern that the Federal Reserve, Bank of England, Bank of Japan, European Central Bank manipulate the money supply in ways that increase or reduce our wealth by either making more money available that reduces our wealth or retracting the money supply. So that's part of the motivation behind Bitcoin, is to get us away from that whole central banking system.
I see that motivation and that reasoning. I thought that the value for the Bitcoin and the blockchain technology or way of doing business was that it sort of freed you from all of that rather than being something like that.
It frees you from our modern system of fiat money, but it's something like the nostalgic systems in terms of which we each had tangible value that we were responsible for and we could transfer without having the interference of government.
Well, if you joined us late, we're talking about money and bitcoins, and I'm privileged to talk to Professor Lawrence Baxter from Duke, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about money, and specifically we're trying to understand what bitcoins are and the advantages of owning it and the risk of owning it. And Professor Baxter is an expert teaching at Duke. And also a few days ago, the Wall Street Journal published his short column called Hooray for Bitcoin, but don't buy it. And in explaining it and explaining it positively about the kinds of things that might be accomplished with a so-called cryptocurrency or some sort of transactional device that takes advantage of the what you call the blockchain. But towards the end, you say, at the first serious and likely coordinated move by governments to regulate or bank the digital currency, Bitcoin's price will crash to zero. Panicked owners will rush to exit, and the bubble will burst. And you basically say eventually the frenzied Bitcoin market is going to disappear and evaporate. Well, can you talk about that and at the same time explain to us how you create a Bitcoin as a sort of a prelude to explaining what the dangers are?
Yeah, sure. Bitcoins are created through a process called mining. So the analogy to gold mining is there. The way Bitcoin's mined is that an extremely complex mathematical puzzle has to be resolved. And this started with a white paper published by a man said to be from Japan.
A mystery man.
Satoshi.
Somebody's going to write a great biography of whoever this was.
Well, they thought they found the man in Australia, but I don't know what's happened to him. In any event, extremely complex mathematical puzzle, and there's a cap on the number that can ever be mined, 21 million bitcoins.
That's the maximum.
Yes.
How many would be out there now? Do we have any idea?
I don't know, to be honest. And the other thing about that 21 million is that they can be subdivided. So you can buy a piece of a Bitcoin, because otherwise 21 million wouldn't go far enough to cover the global economy.
What is the mining operation like?
To solve the puzzles, you have to use enormous computing power. So the computers will run programs until they finally crack the solution for a particular Bitcoin.
And do we know how much time that usually takes?
I've never done it, but I have been told that it can now. It's taking longer and longer because it's been designed in such a way that it gets harder and harder to mine as they start to approach.
Get the 20-some million.
21 million, yeah. What I have seen is photographs of the server farms that are being used to mine it, and they are huge. There are big server farms in rural China. There are some in America and elsewhere. And so the computing power needed now to mine Bitcoin.
Can you make money with these by manufacturing Bitcoins?
A very good question, because you can make money in various ways. The first is to have mined one in which case you get rewarded with it. And nowadays we're talking that's a reward of $20,000 or so, or $19,000. So it's like a miner who strikes gold after a lot of hard work and digging and then discovers gold. But there's other ways to make money.
Let me just stop on this. The manufacturing, the idea that you can manufacture a product and have it sell for $18,000 and essentially only use energy to run your and whatever wear and tear on your computer. Yeah. So you, if you can get something close to free energy,
well, that's the catch.
But you can get efficient energy sources that get close to that. But it just say if you could, and then if you have a computer that operates maybe faster than others, you can jump out and make money off this operation.
Yes, you can. And that raises the question about who else is making money. The suppliers of the hardware, servers, the people who are able to buy those servers and operate them. Of course, when all 21 million are mined, then that'll be the end of the mining. It will be like the depleted gold mines. So money could not be made that way anymore. But keep in mind that you mentioned if you could get close to free energy, right now they are huge consumers of energy. It is said, and I'm not an environmentalist, so I can't validate this personally, but I have read that the energy being used to mine bitcoins now is the equivalent of all of the energy that Denmark uses.
I saw that, yeah.
There are environmental issues. Is this really worth it given the amount of energy that's being consumed? Bitcoin proponents say, well, that's just in the short term, but this will all disappear once bitcoins are fully mined, and we won't burn up energy in that way anymore.
So, there'll be 21 million bitcoins. There'll be a limited supply. Yes, it'll be sort of like gold in the sense.
That's exactly what it's modeled on. The idea is that that there shouldn't be an endless supply of them because then you're back into the inflation problem, fiat money. If you limit it, it's like gold. There's a rarity or scarcity value, and that will help to control the calibration of wealth, that it won't be whimsical, as many people now think it is, at the hands of governments.
Well, nevertheless, I'm wondering whether or not our listeners feel like they can understand how that value is created. But once it's mined, how is the Bitcoin delivered to the miner? And does the program that he's used to solve the problems is just
it'll produce strike,
it says here it is and here's your first little chart with the numbers in it.
That's exactly how it works. And then that miner can then use it in currency, just like somebody who struck gold and sold the gold. So that Bitcoin will be put into the Bitcoin monetary system, and other people will use it, will exchange it, perhaps for dollars or for goods or whatever.
In that respect, it's like the analogy you developed early on with gold. When the gold miner scratches and applies the chemicals and gets the gold and stamps a coin, he has created money.
That's how he's rewarded, yes.
And it's he doesn't have to rely on the Federal Reserve or anything else. He's created that bit of value.
A bag of gold, and it's his, and he's earned it.
And for him, and the person who accepts that, there's always this idea: I could melt this down, or this is valuable. The guy who owns the Bitcoin has got a piece of paper with a bunch of numbers on it,
and hopes that other people will accept it.
Yeah.
And many people are obviously accepting it right now. We can talk about the derivatives exchanges and that. But
we'll talk about just in general that and you raise this a little bit in your article, that the Bitcoin's created not to be the speculative value. It's created to be an efficient medium of exchange that takes care of some of the problems that other traditional mediums of exchange. But with such a high value of Bitcoin, it's hard to use it.
They get subdivided. So, let's assume that a Bitcoin stabilizes at $20,000 a coin. Smaller subdivision equivalents will be used as partial payments. So if you're buying something for what we ordinarily would have spent $100, you would get a fraction of 100 out of 20,000 of a Bitcoin and pay for that. And money has three functions. One is it's a store of value, and so you need a stable price for that. And right now we absolutely do not have a stable price. It's a measure of value, so you need that stability and exchangeability for something else in order to determine what the price of a good is. And it's a store of value, a measure of value, and a medium of exchange. You need everybody to accept it so that they will buy and sell using it. And the ambition of Bitcoin eventually is that it will be so pervasive and so reliable that people will prefer to use it than sovereign currencies. And in theory, that could well happen. I personally believe it'll be a very long time before that happens.
Let's take a quick break and then come back and talk about your caution about what might happen to Bitcoin before all these happy scenarios are realized. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Lawrence Baxter, who's the William B. McGuire Professor of the Practice of Law and co-director of the Global Financial Markets Center at Duke Law School. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Professor Lawrence Baxter from Duke University Law School. He's explaining something which has been inexplicable to me, and that's Bitcoins, how they work, what the advantages to a Bitcoin-like medium of exchange was. And now you're going to tell us a little bit about why it's not going to – why you predict it's not really going to work for Bitcoin.
Okay. Remember that any currency has to be some kind of store of value, and it needs some level of stability, otherwise people won't trust it. So the question is Bitcoin a store of value? Well, we've seen it rocket in price, and a lot of people are puzzled. They say, well, why has it gone up so much? Is it being driven by speculators? Is something else supporting it? Is it the promise of a government-free money that people really believe in? I think it's been driven by a couple of factors. Speculation, because the price has been going up so quickly, there are a lot of speculators in the market buying Bitcoin in the hope later of selling it at a big profit. And then the exchanges that have said, and even in one case begun, to list Bitcoin derivatives. So let's think about what a Bitcoin derivative is. It's either a futures contract on a Bitcoin, a purchase of the right to buy a Bitcoin at a specific price at a later date, or an option on a Bitcoin, which is paying a small fee to exercise the right, but not have to exercise that right at a later date to buy Bitcoin.
It's like a stock option.
Yeah, it's no different from a stock option or from a commodity future like a corn future or an option to buy oil.
It's just another way for investors to conveniently in their minds to invest in the supposedly the changing value.
Yeah, traditionally it's been a way of managing risk. So if you're the farmer, you want to know that you will be able to sell your crop at a specific price the following year. If you are a baker, you will want to buy that coin at a known price. If you're running an airline, you want to buy oil. That's risk management, totally sensible arrangement, and that's been goes back a couple of thousand years. And those are all derivatives. But derivatives are also always susceptible to speculation. Because let's say you buy an option on a particular commodity, and for this purpose, let's call it Bitcoin. The option is a small fee. You don't have to exercise that option. It's like a kind of insurance, and you can leverage up your investment to a huge extent. So if you bought, say, $1 million worth of Bitcoin,
Yes.
You may only pay, say, $1,000 for that option. If, in fact, the price goes up tremendously, you've made a killing because for the sake of a $1,000 fee, you've got the right to buy it at a much lower price. If it goes down, you can walk away, and all you've lost is $1,000. That's traditional and inherent for all derivatives. But a couple of the biggest exchanges announced they were going to list derivatives in the form of futures and options on Bitcoin. One started at the beginning of this week, COBE, and the other one is starting at the end of the week, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. That has given a lot of people who want to find some sort of value in Bitcoin the belief that there therefore is value in Bitcoin. What's really important to know is that the derivative is quite different from the underlying commodity. You can have derivatives on pixies and fairies, and you can trade them because you never touch the underlying commodity. It really doesn't have to exist. But sound derivative traders raise the question, as they have in this case of these two exchanges, there's got to be some kind of intrinsic value there. There's got to be something measurable. And what those who are hostile to this have said is, we can find nothing measurable underneath it other than speculation.
I want to interrupt you and say, well, that's obvious, isn't it? That others have pointed out that it's obvious, but that hadn't kept the speculation in the Bitcoins themselves from going on, and probably is not going to keep some of us who are greedy from speculating in the derivatives.
I agree that it is obvious, and there's money to be made in speculating in derivatives if you're on the right side of the transaction.
Right.
You know, the greater fool theory, which is that you must get out while there are still greater fools than you who are willing to buy.
But getting to the bottom line about your worry about the future demise of the Bitcoin, it's not that it's just that people are buying derivatives and options and things like that. What is your real worry about this?
My real worry is that Bitcoin being freed from central regulation is an ideal method for illegal transactions, for for capital evasion. And we've already seen that in countries like China, where the Bitcoin frenzy has gone through the roof. And the Chinese government is worried about what will happen if it starts to lose value and the people who have invested in Bitcoin panic. It turns into a political problem very quickly. Mm. What will happen if we have, as we've already seen, hackers using Bitcoins to engage in illegal transactions? The Mecklenburg County, for example, was held hostage.
They wanted to be paid in bitcoins,
exactly. Well, that produces an inevitable political impulse to control it. And sure enough, the Chinese government is controlling it, but so too is the New York State. They come up with something called a bit license. And the reason for controlling it is justified on public protection grounds, that we need to know who it is, who's trading in it. We need to have rules with the exchanges, and there needs to be certain types of disclosures.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but your argument is Bitcoin's working fine in all of this, but once the public begins to find out what's going on and publicize it and maybe either regulated or require disclosure of how it's working, that the whole thing will collapse.
Then it's a different – well, that will be one of the factors. Then it becomes a different beast. It is no longer the distributed ledger, but subject to central control, which defeats the whole point of Bitcoin. So that will be one factor. The other is that there's nothing to stop sovereigns – let's call them United States
governments
from issuing their own digital currency. And right now, the Fed is actively looking at something called a Fed coin. The Bank of Japan has said that it is going to issue, and so has the Chinese government said they're going to issue their own digital currencies. Once that happens, we get back to trust. Which one would you trust, the one issued the Fed coin or the Bitcoin? I know where I'd place my bets.
Well, you would be using it for the purpose that it was Bitcoin was originally intended, which is not as a speculative,
but as a convenient,
convenient way for us to trade and commerce and exchange funds.
But once that happens, we're back to the fear of government manipulation.
Well,
because they can control the amount that are being issued.
Well. Lawrence Bechtel, I feel like we've just started. I know a whole lot more than I did before we started this conversation, but I also know a whole lot more about what I don't know.
That's right.
And most
it's mutual, trust me.
Most interesting. Thank you for given us this time and your wisdom. And I hope when I understand it better and can ask better questions that you'll come back and we'll continue this conversation.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Again, my guest has been Professor Lawrence Baxter from Duke University Law School. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to him for being with us. And I look forward to visiting with you again sometime real soon.